the actual session materials and turn things over to today's official MC, Melissa Friedland. And Melissa, feel free to begin.
Thank you, Jean. Welcome, everyone, and thank you all for tuning in to our fourth and final Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar of this fiscal year. My name is Melissa Friedland, and I work with Superfund Redevelopment here at EPA headquarters. I'm so glad you've joined us today as we discuss how capped Superfund sites can provide many different opportunities for reuse. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly webinar series about the reuse of Superfund sites. SRI webinars share site reuse success stories as well as challenges, with the hope that these stories will inspire you to consider reuse on other blighted properties. Each webinar provides guidance, tools, and lessons learned to support the appropriate reuse of these sites. And if you're looking at the picture above, it's a clay liner that's being installed on the Brick Township landfill in Brick Township, New Jersey, in Region 2. Okay. So here is what we'll be covering today. But before we dive into our discussion and case studies, I'm going to share a bit about EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. Our webinar today is centered on the successful reuse of capped Superfund sites. So first, we'll hear from Scott Martin from EPA's Region 4 about the history and redevelopment of the Hercules 009 landfill Superfund site in Brunswick, Georgia. Scott will discuss the transformation of a capped industrial landfill into a car parking area for a dealership. Then we'll hear from Casey Luckett-Snyder from EPA's Region 6 about the history and redevelopment of the Bayou Verdine site in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Casey will discuss the site cleanup of the contaminated wetlands and the redevelopment of the site cap as a pollinator habitat, as well as other areas of the site that have been restored as natural habitat. And finally, we'll hear from Nabil Fayoumi from EPA's Region 5 about the history and redevelopment of the Continental Steel Superfund site. Nabil will discuss the site cleanup and redevelopment of the industrial steel facility in Kokomo, Indiana, where a capped part of the site has been redeveloped as a 29-acre solar farm. And I'll share some resources and contact information. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. So EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment, and returning contaminated sites to productive use supports that mission. Reuse is a priority for EPA and an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. It's important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate. Contaminated sites, like those we'll talk about today, pose unique challenges in terms of both cleanup and reuse. However, they can also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. There are many excellent examples of site reuse from all over the country, everything from pollinator habitat to homes to shopping centers. So I would encourage you to visit the SRI website to find more in-depth information. The link to the SRA website is here and on the slide, and also listed on your resource pod on the right side of your screen. So before we go on to the next slide, I just want to say the solar panels are on the left from North Carolina State University, which is a Superfund site in Region 4. And on the right, it's the Imperial Bag and Paper Company, and there are other businesses that are built on a cap on the PJP Landfill Superfund site in Region 2. Okay. I would also encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page of the SRI website to learn more about specific organizations that have partnered with SRI to assist in Superfund site reuse. Collaborating with these organizations helps SRI provide appropriate tools and resources to turn reuse visions and plans into reality. SRI currently has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land, and the Pollinator Partnership. These organizations are familiar with Superfund and willing to work with communities to explore reuse opportunities and available resources for their local Superfund sites. So one final note, please feel free to ask questions of our presenters. We'll try to answer questions after each section, but we may hold some questions if we think future presenters will address them. We'll have some time at the end for remaining questions. So with that, Scott is going to kick off our discussion of successful reuse of CAP Superfund sites with an introduction to the Hercules 009 landfill Superfund site. Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay, and so Scott will get your materials up here in but one moment. And Scott, you should have questions, so feel free to begin whenever you're ready.
Okay, I'm here. Just waiting for the slides to come up. They're up now. I'm Scott Martin. I'm a remedial project manager in the Superfund division in EPA's Region 4. I've been with EPA for about 23 years, got my start in the air division, and I've been in Superfund for a little over a decade. And as we mentioned, I'm going to talk to you about reusing the cap at the Hercules 009 landfill to serve as a parking lot for a nearby car dealership. I'll give you a brief history of the site, what the cleanup involved, some of the reuse planning, the outcomes of the reuse, and some of the lessons learned. The Hercules 009 landfill is located in Brunswick, Georgia, which is on the southeastern coast of Georgia, very close to St. Simons Island and the beaches down there. I'm going to try to do the arrow. So the landfill is up here in a little bit north of Brunswick, and then down here on the map where it actually says Brunswick was the Hercules manufacturing facility that actually manufactured toxaphene until the mid-1980s. And I'm actually associated with a Superfund site over there as well. The waste product from the manufacturing processes at the Hercules facility would go by truck up the road and up to the Hercules 009 landfill, where they were then disposed of. The facility manufactured toxaphene from the mid-40s to the early 1980s, and it was an agricultural pesticide used to treat boll weevils, ticks, and mites on cattle. And the landfill is approximately 7 acres in size, with the actual site boundaries being a little bigger than that. here's the site. The landfill is located up in this area, in the parcel that's owned by Hercules 009, or Hercules, is this red line area, and there's a neighborhood in this area. The way the site kind of came on to the attention of the Georgia Environmental Protection Division was back in the 80s, they began to find toxaphene-contaminated soils around the landfill and along the road that trucks would haul the waste sludge to the landfill. And eventually in 1982, EPA banned the production of toxaphene, and this ended the operation of the Hercules facility for toxaphene. They did continue to operate and develop different products, but they stopped manufacturing of toxaphene. And eventually the site was added to the National Priorities List in 1984. A couple years later, we came out with a couple of different records of decisions. One of them was to connect all nearby residents to city water. And then the other record of decision was for the cleanup of the landfill itself. And the main component of that landfill, of the remedy, was excavation and cleanup of contaminated soils around the landfill, and then essentially to solidify the contamination in the six cells of the landfill. And they basically just mixed it with cement to solidify it in 1 to 3 feet of thickness. And then originally it was just going to have a soil cap of about 12 inches on top with a regular vegetated cover, as you would typically see at a standard landfill. So these two photos are, one is of a groundwater well, which we still have part of the operation and maintenance is to continually monitor the groundwater on the surrounding site. And then the picture on the left is a view of the cap. And you can see the cars off in the distance and then the stormwater retention pond there. So during the construction of the remedy, communications took place between EPA, Hercules, and the nearby car dealership that they began to express interest in the possibility of the landfill to be used as an overflow parking lot for display and storage of vehicles. So went through a process of, you know, instead of just using the vegetative cap, did some re-engineering to basically come up with an asphalt cap, and the area was fenced and began to be used to store cars. And this, you know, actually ended up being a better cap than was originally designed, you know, for the landfill, since now you have the vegetative cover and an asphalt layer. And an added benefit that the dealership likes is the landfill cap is actually higher than the surrounding areas, so as people drive by, they can actually get a better view of the cars that are on display. So that was just kind of a coincidence that it ended up being higher than the surrounding area. If you saw on the previous figure, the landfill doesn't take up the entire parcel of the former facility. Down on the southern end, it's kind of a grassy area, and there's a pond or a wetlands area. And Hercules, over the years, has began to do things to enhance that area as well, more for, I guess, ecological reuse, if you want to call it. They've added basking logs and cover boards to attract animals, and they have wildlife cameras to help to record activity, and they've seen raccoons, foxes, squirrels, and other large birds at the site. And they've also began to work with the Wildlife Habitat Council on a conservation certificate for the pond area, and Hercules also conducts activities with the nearby College of Coastal Georgia on a partnership that brings students and faculty to the site for plant and animal research. So these photos are just pictures of the, you know, the nearby car dealership. The car dealership has actually changed, I think, a couple times over the past few years between various different, you know, Honda or Nissan, but it still continues to be used as a parking area for the dealership. Hercules still owns the property, and so they lease the landfill cap to the car dealership. And so these are just couple of different views. Again, the picture on the left, you can kind of see how the landfill sits up above the nearby areas, and then, you know, just the cars there that are on display, and, or, you know, the extra cars that they keep the inventory there. And And these photos are of the kind of southern area that I was talking about that currently is basically just a big field that Hercules maintains by mowing. And one thing we've begun to discuss with them is if they'd be interested in perhaps turning that area into a wildflower area that would serve as a pollinator habitat. And that way, you know, it provides an area for the pollinators as well as decrease the maintenance costs associated with mowing. And these photos are of the pond there that's on the southern end of the facility. You know, it's got logs and just natural habitat, and wildlife is attracted to it. So some of the lessons learned are the one that, you know, always comes up, I think. It's never too early to get involved. Communicate as much as you can early and often, and that can help shape, you know, the outcome of your remedial project. You know, like, again, this one originally was just going to be a simple cap. And so during the design process, they modified the cap to accommodate the desired reuse of a parking lot. Reuse is a good enhancement for all sides. You know, Superfund used to be we'd build these landfills and put a fence around it and lock it up and walk away. But, you know, now more and more the focus is on reuse and turning these sites back into, you know, viable projects for the community. And like I said, it's never too late to also consider continued reuse, adapting, for instance, you know, what I mentioned about the pollinator habitat, that has always been just kind of a mowed field, but even now, you know, pushing 20 years after the remedy was done, Hercules is still looking to possibly change that into another beneficial reuse of pollinator habitat. And that's basically my brief summary there of the Hercules Double Line Landfill. My contact information is here if you have any more questions. I can always get more detailed information from the remedial design documents or remedial action reports if anybody needs any further details. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. We have a couple of questions for you, so we'll take some now and then we'll get to some of them at the end. But someone is asking, did you have vents for the landfill that had to be moved to be able to cover the site with asphalt? And how many acres are paved?
I don't believe there are any vents at the site. And the landfill is about 7 acres, so the paved area, I'm not totally sure. It's less than that, but it does basically use up the entire surface of the former landfill. I think maybe it is approximately 7 acres, actually. And then the groundwater monitoring network is around the perimeter of the landfill, of course, which is, you know, fairly typical.
Okay. And let's take one more and then we'll move on. Someone's asking about toxithene. What are the components of the waste from toxithene manufacturing?
What are the components of the waste?
Yeah.
You know, it was basically their off product, toxithene and sludges from the operating facility, as well as other debris and things just from the main facility, that all went into the landfill.
Okay, I guess we can follow up later if we need to. Let's do one more. What would be the contaminant impact to sediment or surface water in the pond area?
Luckily, there was not found to be any impact on the pond in the southern area there. There was a, near there, there was a soil removal along the road that came into the landfill that did have toxaphene in it that was basically spilled over from the trucks carrying it in, but there was no cleanup action conducted on that on the wetland area on the south end of the site because there was not any contamination there.
Okay, great. Let's move on. And those of you who submitted questions, we will get to them at the end. Thank you, Scott. Let's move on to Casey Luckett.
Hi, Melissa.
And
hi,
everybody.
Hello, my name is Casey Luckett Snyder. And I am a remedial project manager and the Superfund reuse coordinator here in Region 6. Today, I'm going to be talking about the cleanup and the reuse of the Bayou-Verdine Superfund site located in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And one of the most awesome things about this site for me personally is that not only was I the remedial project manager who oversaw the cleanup, but now, as the Superfund reuse coordinator here in the region, I get to tout this as an immense and enormous ecological revitalization success for EPA and here in Region 6. So presentation overview, I think it's pretty straightforward. The history of the site, we'll go through that a little bit. Site cleanup, reuse planning, the reuse outcomes, and then some of the lessons learned and things that I took away from this project. Okay, so start with the site history. Where the heck is Bayou-Verdine? It's located near Westlake, Louisiana, which is actually just outside of Lake Charles, Louisiana. That's in the southwest part of Louisiana. It's about 130 miles west of Baton Rouge to kind of orient you in the state. And on the map, you'll see where Bayou-Verdine is located, which is, again, west of Lake Charles, and it is part of the Calcasieu River ecosystem. Petroleum refinery and petrochemical facilities operated on the site for decades, and during which time their operations and everyday activities contaminated bayou sediments with PAHs, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, as well as heavy metals. In 2003, EPA completed the Calcasieu Estuary investigation, the remedial investigation, and that remedial investigation basically found that the contamination in Bayou-Verdine did not pose a threat to people, but it was did pose an ecological risk. So there was a potential for it to cause harm to plants and animals within the bayou. In 2010, Phillips 66 and Safol, who were the potentially responsible parties, or PRPs, for this site, signed a consent decree with EPA, agreeing to clean up Bayou-Verdine. EPA approved the Removal Action Work Plan in December 2011, and the cleanup work began in September of 2012. The final remedy selected for this non-time-critical removal action addresses the bayou sediments contaminated with PAHs and heavy metals, and the remedy involved sediment excavation, consolidation, and capping of containment ponds that were already located on the Phillips 66 refinery property. The cleanup parties, EPA and the PRPs, first prepared the settling basin to receive the sediments that were going to be dredged from the bayou. As I mentioned, there were two pre-existing ponds on the Phillips 66 refinery. Apropos named the West Pond and the East Pond on the map above. And those ponds had been created decades before during the construction of Interstate 10. The Phillips 66 refinery sits adjacent to Interstate 10. For the cleanup, the East Pond was converted into the settling basin that would be needed to implement the removal action. The pond was emptied by pumping the water into the bayou, and then the bottom sediments were solidified by mixing fly ash and putting in a drainage system at the bottom of the basin. Finally, a 60-mil high-density polyliner was installed at the bottom of the settling basin as extra precaution. One of the really cool things that I wanted to mention is when Phillips 66 needed to drain the ponds, we ran into, they had been there for decades, and obviously over the years, as Bayou Verdine had flooded, the ponds had filled up with fish from the bayou. However, because those ponds were not connected to the bayou, they were stuck there. So the cleanup parties made every effort to relocate all those fish from the east and west ponds back to the bayou before they started draining. At first, they started with the electroshock system that you've seen on the back of little John boats, and that worked okay, but it wasn't great. So for several weeks, the cleanup parties, the responsible parties, actually paid their contractor to sit out there in boats with fishing poles and catch fish and take them over to the bayou. After the containment cell was created in the east pond, the bayou dredging followed. The cleanup parties used hydraulic dredging as well as mechanical excavation to remove the top 1 to 2 feet of contaminated sediments from approximately 2 miles of Bayou Verdine, both on the Phillips 66 refinery property and downstream of the property of the refinery. The dredged sediment and the water mixture, which was created a slurry, was then pumped through a pipeline that had been installed from the bayou to the settling basin. The sediments were allowed to separate from the water by gravity. The water was then sampled before it was released into Bayou Verdine in accordance with a discharge permit issued by the state of Louisiana. In total, almost 52,000 cubic yards of contaminated bayou sediments were placed in the East Pond containment cell before its closure. During the cleanup process, EPA and the Calcasieu Estuary Task Force, which was made up of a group of local leaders and other academic folks and other people who were interested in the cleanup action, we all solicited community participation and suggestions for improvements, particularly in making sure that the public clearly understood what was going on during the cleanup. EPA provided fact sheets to the task force and to the community to keep them informed during the cleanup, especially, as I mentioned, because some of the cleanup happened near I-10 and it was very visible. So we wanted to be sure everybody knew exactly what was going on. Okay, so this is just a little bit of an overview of the timeline. The cleanup began in 2012. We finished dredging in February of 2014, then came the sediment solidification, and then the liner was finally installed in December 2014. The picture on the left shows the solidification of sediments using fly ash in the settling basin back in October of 2014, and the picture on the right shows the installation of the containment cell top liner in December 2014. So now we get to the fun part, the reuse planning part. One of the other really neat things about this particular cleanup and this project and working with these responsible parties that they were very interested in implementing a number of green remediation efforts from start to finish with this project. So a lot of green remediation concepts were put into practice and thereby reducing the project's environmental impacts. So I just wanted to hit a couple of those highlights. I mentioned a few minutes ago the relocation of the fish when the settling basin was created. But they really embraced the reuse, reduce, recycle mantra. All of the old tires that were recovered during the clearing and grading were recycled. They recycled all their paper products and all their plastic bottles. And in fact, there wasn't recycling on the facility itself, so we had to collect all the bottles in the back of a pickup truck and then drive it to the recycling facility. They reused the guard shack as the treatment plant office later during the phase of the cleanup. Like I said, this is all located on the refinery property, so access was controlled via a guard for most of the project. They adjusted road construction to preserve a number of large trees, and they pruned whenever possible instead of removing the trees. One of the other things that I thought was really neat was all of the trees that had to be taken down during the settling pond construction. They preserved all those and stacked them in various locations around the periphery so that they could create, those downed trees would create micro animal habitats. And then you'll see in just a few minutes how they later used those downed trees as part of the ecological enhancements of the site. They also selected a treatment technology utilizing gravity settling instead of something that would have to be manually agitated and then settled, so that reduced the need for pumps and the associated emissions. They used electric motors and biodegradable lubricants in their boats and in all the dredge equipment. During the cleanup, ecological reuse of the site was considered. As the site cleanup started to draw to a close and we were looking at closing the containment settling basins and the containment cells, I encouraged Phillips 66 and Southall to think outside of the box or think outside of our work plan. The work plan that everybody had agreed to back in 2011 was pretty standard, called for putting a grass cover on the cap and mowing it in perpetuity. So we started discussing amongst ourselves what we could do different at this site and how we could make it this area or convert this area into a real gem as far as the ecological habitat goes. And we all agreed that improving the ecological functioning of the containment cell area would be a valuable addition to the project. As I said, the East and West Ponds were created decades earlier to provide fill for the construction of I-10, so their ecological function was very limited, again, because they were not connected to the bayou. The cleanup parties developed an ecological revitalization plan that would make the West Pond a functioning part of Bayou Verdine's wetland ecology by recreating a channel, which we called a bioswale, to connect the West Pond to Bayou Verdine. The plan also called for planting native wildflowers on the containment cell to create habitat for pollinators. And you can see the image above is the initial design schematic that they created and submitted to EPA. So as we were getting started with the ecological revitalization, the West Pond had to be deepened. So the pond sediments, they were clean sediments. We had never put any contaminated sediments into the West Pond. But the clean pond sediments in the bottom of the West Pond were removed and then placed on top of the dredged bayou sediments that were already in the East Pond. About 15,000 cubic yards of West Pond sediments were placed in the East Pond, and then fly ash was mixed into the sediments to solidify them. Although the consent decree required only 1 foot of soil cover on the containment cell, the cleanup parties increased the protectiveness by including a synthetic liner, a drainage system, and then 2 feet of soil. Then the upper liner was welded to the lower liner. The cleanup was completed in April of 2015, and the cleanup parties will monitor the remedy in the site for the next 30 years. Again, it's located on Phillips 66 refinery property, so they'll be able to monitor that for the next 30 years. Groundwater monitoring takes place every 3 years, and they've already started the monthly inspections of the containment cell. The key ecological concept was to hydraulically connect the West Pond to Bayou Verdine, which allowed that pond to then function as part of the bayou and the estuary ecosystem. To achieve this goal, a channel was built along the northern edge of the containment cell to connect the West Pond to Bayou Verdine. And rather than creating a sterile ditch traditionally lined with riprap, the cleanup parties designed this bioswale with multiple ecological components to provide habitat and control erosion of the containment cell. To promote the growth of native plant species, native willow trees and cattails were transported from adjacent areas on the refinery and planted along the banks of the bioswale. A small sand and gravel bed was also created along the northern bank of the bioswale to serve as an area for aquatic nesting beds. Log weirs and root wads from the trees saved during the site clearing and grubbing were installed in the bioswale to create habitat and, again, control erosion. The next two slides that you'll see show the progression of the cap construction and closure over time. On the left, you'll see the unvegetated capped containment area and the beginnings of the channel and the bioswale in January of 2015. On the right, you'll see a more clearly defined channel, and if you look closely, the hydro seeding of the site in February 2015. The dark spots that you see on the cap area are the areas or the portions of the cap that were reserved for planting the pollinator habitat. The cap itself is approximately 4 acres in size, and approximately 1 acre was planted with the pollinator habitat in 8 different locations. On this slide, on the left, you'll see the grass beginning to fill in around springtime, March 2015. And on the right, you'll see it's had all of spring and all of nice, warm Louisiana summers to become much more fully vegetated, both the capped area and the bioswale as of September 2015. The site's ecological enhancements are working really, really well. The site now provides habitat for waterfowl, fish, blue crabs, alligators, snakes, honeybees, deer, raccoon, possums have been spotted. The photo on the left is a photo of a great egret. It's actually taken by the Phillips 66 project manager. He's an amateur. In fact, all of these photos were taken by him. But that's an exceptionally good one. He's an amateur photographer, that's one of my favorite photos. And then there's a really nice-looking blue crab on the other side, which Louisiana is famous for as far as seafood goes. Then to provide habitat for bees, butterflies, and other pollinator species, 8 areas of the containment cell's capped surface were seeded with 6 species of wildflowers, including dense blazing star, clasping coneflower, black-eyed Susan, primrose, and butterfly weed, also known as milkweed. Each of these native species attracts pollinators and thrives in the hot, humid conditions that southern Louisiana is famous for. These photos show the pollinator habitat filling in on the cap site over time. The planting of the pollinator habitat will expand to include much of the containment cell cover. And, of course, the plus side is these native wildflowers don't require mowing, and they ultimately reduce the maintenance required. In October 2015, EPA Region 6 was proud to present Phillips 66 and Sasol with a Green Innovations Award. The award recognized their above and beyond efforts to achieve sustainable and ecological revitalization with the construction of the ecological enhancements at the CAP closure site. This photo shows me with the Phillips 66 site project managers who really made this ecological revitalization at Bayou Verdine a reality. Later in 2016, I was nominated for and received EPA's National Notable Achievement Award for the innovation and sustainability of the Bayou Verdine cleanup and reuse. So lessons learned. Ultimately, this site's reuse emphasizes the need to approach your project with out-of-the-box thinking. You don't necessarily have to stick to exactly what the work plan says you're going to do if everybody agrees there's a better way to do it. Although an unconventional reuse may not work at every site, extra effort usually pans out. Finally, I think the most important lesson learned and my takeaway from this project was that open, honest communication and collaboration between site stakeholders and EPA was absolutely essential for planning the cleanup and the reuse. That reflects kind of a new way of thinking about capped landfill sites. There's a better way than putting a grass cover down and having to mow it forever. And I'm hoping that some examples like this and the one that Scott just provided will help us to really think outside of the box as far as what can we do with capped sites. And lastly, there's my contact information. If you have any questions about the Bayou Verdine project, feel free to email or call me at any time.
Casey, that was a great story. Thank you so much. We have a couple of questions, and maybe we'll take some of them now, and then we'll get to the others at the end. But I think everyone's written in saying they want one of those jobs to be on the boat and go fishing. So,
me too. And to get paid for it, right? Yeah, that's the best.
Hey, right. That's the best part. So maybe one of the follow-up question is the public allowed access to the site?
No, unfortunately, they're not. This was strictly an ecological enhancement project. We have written it up in an EPA Superfund reuse case study to share with the public. That's available on our website. But no, access to the refinery is restricted to the public.
Okay. Okay. And someone's written in, are there any issues with crabs or fish being caught and consumed?
In Calcasieu Estuary as a whole?
I guess around the site. So have they been tested for?
Yes. The RIFS for Calcasieu Estuary happened in the early 2003, I believe. So happened in the early 2000s, and there was a fish advisory placed in Calcasieu Estuary at that time.
Okay, great. Let's take one more, and then we'll move on. How deep is the root zone of the wildflowers, and is there an impact on the final cover because of deeper root zones?
No, we Phillip 66 worked with I'm trying to remember who it was, a local ag extension service to make sure that the species that they were selecting were going to have a shallower root zone and not going to impact the cap. But it, and if you remember, though, they put an extra 2 feet of fill on top when only 1 foot was actually required in the work plan. So they've got good clearance as far as root zone goes.
Okay, that's great. Actually, I just have one follow-up question about the root zone. I guess someone's worried about trees and shrubs damaging the integrity of the cap, and so I guess you have a you have an extra layer, and I guess you're very careful about what kinds of species you use so that they wouldn't come do damage to the cap.
Right, right. So Phillip 66, during their monthly inspections, kind of looks for any species that are invading the capped area that weren't planted there, and they selectively remove those if that's going to cause a problem.
Okay, great. And we just have one last question for right now, and that is, we've had a number of other presentations where people have worked with large corporations, and there was a person in the corporation called a sustainability person. Did you have that at Phillip 66?
Phillip 66 has a sustainability coordinator. However, they were not involved with the project until afterwards. There's a great YouTube video that their sustainability folks did of the EPA Greenovations Award presentation to Phillip 66. I'm not really a YouTube person, but I think you can just like go on YouTube and type in Phillip 66 and Bioverdeen, and it'll find it. And it's a great, you know, 2 or 3 minute video that talks all about the project. So I didn't work directly with their sustainability program, but certainly they were involved at the end to recognize the project.
That is great. Okay, thanks again. Don't go away.
Got it. I won't.
Let's move on to Nabil for our last case study.
And Nabil, you should see your materials coming up, and feel free to start whenever you're ready.
Yes, thank you. Okay, my name is Nabil Fayoumi, and I am a remedial project manager in Region 5. I have been, now, just 1 second, for some reason I'm getting my caption screen and not my PowerPoint presentation screen, sorry about that.
Nabil, it just might be a matter of minimizing or shrinking it back down to the normal view, so if you can hover your cursor in the upper right, you should see an option to click the four arrow button to shrink down whatever window you've maximized.
Okay.
And if it doesn't come back, we can take over clicking for you as long as you can keep talking on the phone.
Okay, we'll do. Okay, it's back, but it's in a minimized version. That's fine. Sorry about that. I have been with the EPA for 19 years. I'm an RPM in Region 5. I have been on RPM for 13 years. Before that, for 6 years, I was with the Waste Management Division with the EPA here in Region 5. Before that, I was a TAT and a START team member contractor, and I did work for the Superfund removal program. I have an overview of my presentation. The site is located in Kokomo, Indiana. This is about 15 miles north of Indianapolis, just to give you an idea. It is a fun lead, and it's made up of 183-acre site, and the site is divided into six operable units. There's a creek that runs into the site. There's also a former quarry that was used for waste disposal as well. The facility produced nails, wire fence from scrap metals, and I would like to mention that the cables for the Golden Gate Bridge were manufactured at the Continental Steel site. Facility operation resulted contamination of soil, sediment, sludge, and groundwater. The contaminant of concerns at the site are volatile organic compounds, PCBs, PAHs, and metals. Next few slides, I have site history and a few milestones. Major milestones for the site. In 1927, the facility emerged as what known today as the Continental Steel site. It's worth mentioning that the facility filed for final bankruptcy in 1985. EPA listed the site on the National Priority List in 1990. Cleanup at the site was completed in 2010. That was 2 years ahead of schedule, and it's worth noting here that in 2009, the project received the Recovery Act money that was available that expedited the cleanup at the site. In 2013, we implemented institutional control at the site, and this is when the city took over the site ownership. In 2016, the City of Kokomo Plan Commission approved the construction of the $10 million solar array park at 26 acres of the site, an area that used to be known as the main plant area, and I will show a map of that next. The construction of the solar array park was completed in December 2016. And it's been operating since. In March 2017, there was a ribbon cutting ceremony where the EPA, the city, the state, and various stakeholders celebrated the site going from a brownfield to clean energy facility. This is an old aerial of the site, and you can see here there's a creek that runs through the site. There's also this area here is the main plant, and this is the area where will be the focus of this discussion today. However, as I mentioned, there's six operable units. This here is the former quarry that I referenced to earlier. I'll be talking about that briefly. Over here is what we call the acid lagoon areas, and these used to be sludge drying lagoons that the facility utilized. And then over here we used to have another operable unit that called the slag processing area. As you can see, the facility's operation contaminated the creek, the acid lagoon area, the quarry, and the main plant. Two things I would like to mention here. This quarry, it used to be 80 feet deep, was full of water. It had a pH of 12. Our plan was to go in there and do hydraulic dredging. However, when we went out there, we ran into drums and metal debris, so we had to change that. So we end up pumping that quarry dry, and literally it took us 1 month of continuous pumping 24/7 to get it dry, and then we were able to mechanically excavate or mechanically dredge the bottom of it. It's worth mentioning because I do have a small reuse success story at this quarry. This quarry is currently being used by the city of Kokomo as a stormwater retention pond, and the city is pretty pleased with that. And also at the Markland Quarry, we do have a small green remediation component of the remedy that we selected. The EPA installed 3 wind turbines that are generating about 75% of the electricity needed to operate the groundwater extraction system. Another success story I would like to briefly mention, even though it's not the focus of this presentation really, is this acid lagoon area here. The city, EPA, and IDEM are working on reuse plans for a 60-acre recreational soccer field called the Wildcat Creek Soccer Complex. This complex will enhance the community's connection to recreation and outdoor activities. This complex will include 30 full and youth-sized soccer fields. We'll also have a mile and a quarter walking trails, concession stands, storage and restroom facilities, and parking for 400 vehicles. This is an old photo of Continental Steel in its old busy days. This is the main plant, and this is the area where you will see we installed the solar panel park. Obviously, a lot of buildings were demolished. A lot of underground storage tanks were pulled out, and it does not look like anything like this nowadays. Same thing, next slide. This is a photo, an old photo of Continental Steel inside of how it used to look. So EPA launched a 20-year cleanup at the site, and the cleanup costed about $66 million. There was a huge commitment from the state where they came up with $5 million of their $5 million upfront to clean the main plant, which encouraged the EPA to come up with almost $50 million to do work at the rest of the site. So as of today, remedial action is complete for the whole site except for the groundwater, which is in long-term remedial action phase. The work itself, as I mentioned earlier, I talked about the dredging of the quarry, but we also did some dredging of the creek itself and removed some drums. We also excavated contaminated soil from the main plant, the processing area, the acid lagoon area, and we also installed a soil cover cap at these areas as well. We also demolished buildings, took out underground storage tanks. And in 2013, institutional controls were implemented. Work was completed other than the groundwater, and those properties were turned over to the city for reuse plans. As far as coordination of reuse, consideration, and remediation, EPA and the state and the city are working on reuse plans at the site since 2001, really, and that included a $100,000 grant to the city of Kokomo. Through that grant and that work, the site was identified as a great fit for a solar project because the area has a great energy infrastructure. We also have a receptive city, and also due to industrial area, we have a high energy demand. During the coordination, we, the EPA and the state, helped the developer to understand the Superfund remedial process and how to adapt their approach to fit with the selected remedy constraints on this property. Working with the developer closely, the developer ensured the EPA and the state that the panels would not disturb the soil cap. They worked with us to design a racking foundation for the panels that minimized the impact of the panels on the cab. As far as site reuse outcome, we completed the installation of 21,000 solar panels, and this is on a 26-acre portion of the main plant. This is a $10 million green energy project that's expected to provide electricity for 1,000 homes. And as you can see from the success story that I listed for the quarry, that the city is using it as a stormwater retention pond, and the soccer field complex at the Acid Lagoon area, this site is an example of how Superfund sites can support multiple site uses and how reuse demands and interests can expand and change over time. The transformation from contaminated Superfund site to solar park and soccer field complex has been really inspiring and a win-win situation for all stakeholders. There's an aerial of the solar park at the main plant, and as I said, you could, as I pointed out in the old aerial photo, how that old plant used to look. The main plant used to look at all these buildings. This is an aerial that was taken by a drone after the construction of the solar park. As far as lesson learned, really the site has been highly successful and experienced nothing but great cooperation and coordination and resulted in great execution. That was pretty hard to come up with lesson learned. However, as mentioned earlier in earlier slide, early planning is the key when it comes to reuse. As I mentioned, for the soccer field complex, we identified those plans during the remedial action, and because we did that early enough, we were able to use a seed that was suitable for turf for soccer fields. So early planning helped us there. As far as reuse plan in general, I have been involved with this project since 2005, and every year we have a different reuse plans that we talked about and we considered, and a lot of these reuse plans have not really materialized and nothing came out of them. So by staying the course and staying active and getting the community involved, getting the city involved, we were able to get to a point where we identified that solar park was the option going forward. Even though when we did the pilot test in 2001, a solar park was identified as a good use for that site. However, it took us quite a few years and explored other reuse potentials first before we came back and considered solar as a reuse for the site. So staying the course is pretty important. I did talk briefly too about the kind of coordination that took place with the developer when it came to explaining to them the remedy, what entails, and what kind of limitation we have, and things we expect them to do in order for our remedy to stay protective. And it worked out pretty good, but it took some close coordination, and all in all, it was a pretty good experience. However, the developer and their banks were concerned with the brownfield liability associated with the property, even though we have institutional control in place, even though we wrote the City of Kokomo a comfort letter, we still have to work with the developer and their banks on issuing another comfort letter just to make sure that they are comfortable moving forward. So we were able to utilize the Superfund reuse tool in this particular case, the comfort letter, just to help ease some of the developer and their bank concern. So I would say this project resulted because of a unique collaboration between EPA, state, and the community. We created these reuse potentials at the site, and in this case, we have a solar park, a stormwater retention pond, and a 60-acre soccer field complex. Next slide. Here, the next slide is a few people I would like to mention that they were involved with this project, and they contributed a great deal. Next, I will have two videos that I would like to show. I would like to emphasize that the ribbon cutting ceremony, it's an EPA video that was done by the EPA here in Region 5. I would like to emphasize that video is a draft at this point and has not been finalized. This is something I would like to make note of. So if you could please go ahead and show these videos, that would be great.
Okay, so we're going to call up two videos. And just a reminder, I'd like all of my presenters to make sure their phone lines are muted. And for those of you who are joining us in the webinar, the video sound will play back through your computer speakers. Unfortunately, for those of you on the phone lines, the audio just doesn't come through on the videos that way. So if you want to hear the videos, you'll need to turn on or turn up your computer speakers. I can see links as well in the Q&A windows if you have problems watching the video. Again, I'm going to move on to the next video. Bear with me. So again, just real quickly, we'll call up that video.
This is the former Continental
and
Steel site that employed thousands and thousands of people in Kokomo for generations. Went out of business in 1986. After it closed for years, it stood here rusting, decaying.
That placard that we gave out was given to the City of Kokomo for out-of-the-box thinking and being very determined after 16 years of sticking with it to have the site be brought back to the fruition of being redeveloped for something that's useful.
I heard that a few people have tried for quite some time to figure out how to reuse this site, and solar seemed like a good fit. Well, I mean, if there was a lot of bureaucracy, we didn't see it. They really accommodated us from what the original plan was to what you see today.
What I'm finding with the Superfund reuse program is that not only are we cleaning up sites and making them productive, but we're also increasing the locals' property value taxes, because once somebody lives next to a Superfund site, property values come down. Once we reuse the Superfund site, property values go back up. After we're done with the cleanup, we show them that this site can be put back into productive reuse and the environment can be protected.
It feels great to just take a piece of property that's contaminated and return it to the community where it's being put to good use. It feels really good. As good as this might look, this is just one example out of many. This is really what the EPA is about, taking contaminated piece of properties, turn it into a property that's being used and it's beneficial to the local community.
Okay, Nabil, I'll take us back to your final slide, and we can go ahead and close out with your presentation. Bear with me, guys.
Okay, here's my phone number and email, my contact information. If anybody have any question, any issues, any similar projects, I'll be happy to help.
Okay, thank you. So I think we'll stop for some questions, Nabil.
Great. Nabil, that was terrific. Thank you very much. And it's great we could see you and we could see Tom Bloom, who's a Superfund redevelopment coordinator just like Casey Luckett, and there's a Superfund redevelopment coordinator in every EPA region. So Nabil, a number of people have written in the same question. Everybody's worried about burrowing animals. So how did we deal with that? Did we say we were worried about it, or did we do special things to avoid it? How did we handle it?
I really don't think that was an issue for us. I think just geographically speaking, where that piece of property, one side it's bordered by the creek, and one side it still has one existing wall of what the main plant used to be. So, and there's, you know, a lot of activities going on. So in that area where the site is located, we really don't have a lot of animal traffic. That was an issue for us.
Okay, and how about snow? How does the solar facility deal with snow?
Well, we had a model. We started operating the system in January and February, and we had a mild winter season. I do not recall that snow being an issue. Are we talking about snow on the panels themselves, or between the rows, or?
Any information you want to give us, I think, would be great.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of information as far as snow is concerned, because it's been a mild year, and it's in Kokomo, Indiana. It's even milder than our Chicago office. Again, that hasn't really been an issue for us, but I'll be happy to look into that.
Okay, great. And let's take one more question, and then we'll change things up a little bit. What type of ballasted system was used for the solar project, and did you bury the electrical wire or keep it above ground?
Well, I think it was a combination of buried wire, but some of it is above ground too. But it did not interfere with our soil cover, so to speak.
Okay. Okay. Let's take one more before we do it. So, how do you maintain what do you do with the ground below the solar panels? Are you able to mow it, or what happens?
Well, we have enough spacing between the rows where we could mow with no problem, but also a big portion of the facility we have gravel laid down where in the critical area with you know, obviously that need to be accessed more frequent, where we have gravel put down and stone, so make it accessible. However, for areas where we need to mow, there's plenty of spacing between these rows where we don't have a problem mowing when we need to.
Okay, that's great. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to get Gene to, you want to give them instructions on?
Yep, we're going to call up a series of survey questions on the screen. You'll still have an option to send in questions and comments near the lower right of your screen. But while we open up the floor to some outstanding questions and comments, I'll invite everyone to scroll through the questions up on the screen and share your thoughts. We're looking for your interest in future topics from the SRI webinar series, as well as if you would like to be included on future email distribution lists specifically about this topic when new webinars are announced.
Okay, so I think the first question is for me, and it's someone wanted more information on the grant from US EPA for $100,000, and we don't do that anymore. So the site was very lucky. They were able to receive it when we did it. We do have a lot more services than we did then, more in-kind planning services, and we're happy to talk to you about that, but we no longer give out, they're actually cooperative agreements. And we actually have a question that someone wrote in for all three presenters. There we go. Okay, so we're really interested in your thoughts on how you all felt, how you did your collaboration. How did you get started? What did you think was particularly effective? And maybe I could start with Casey on that. But you were a big proponent of out-of-the-box thinking, so maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. First of all, I think it's really important early in introductions with your stakeholders, particularly in my case, that was the site project managers for Phillips 66 and Sasol, to develop a positive team-oriented relationship, because that honestly was the key to making the Bayou Verdean ecological revitalization a success, because when we started working together to implement the remedial action work plan, we were already a team. And there were a number of issues that came up throughout the couple of years of the removal action that we addressed as a team. Didn't have anything to do with ecological revitalization, had to do with the removal action itself. But we addressed those as a team. We respected each other, we worked together, and that led to a very collaborative relationship. So when it got to the point where we were discussing the closure of the containment cells, and I had gone back and looked at what the work plan called for, they were very receptive to my ideas. I am the Superfund reuse coordinator, as Melissa mentioned, and so, you know, I had some ideas for the site. I mean, it's obviously restricted use because it's on refinery property, so that kind of lended itself to the ecological reuse side of things. And so when we started talking about it, Phillips 66 and Sasol were very receptive to it because we had developed such a good working relationship.
Okay, thanks. And Scott Martin, do you have anything to add to that about how did your collaboration work when you guys broached the idea, or they broached the idea to you about what they'd like to do with the site?
Well, I actually wasn't the RPM at the time of the cleanup, but I think it just sort of lent itself to the process, in that, you know, there was a landfill cap being installed, and immediately adjacent to the property is a car dealership, and so I think that sort of sparked the interest from the car dealership, and talk started that way.
Okay, thanks. Nabil, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. You know, Continental Steel, as I said, is a fund lead, so it was really just us, the state, the city, and the community, and the city was really, City of Kokomo was instrumental in exploring various reuse options for the sites through the year, and I think that helps. In this particular case, they took this project where it was vacant, and you know, they had no use for it, and now the city is generating about $30,000 a month revenue renting it to Duke Energy, and they, again, same thing with the stormwater pond and the soccer field, where the community is really being involved, and so the city was really supportive, and was really creative too, where, you know, we probably explored at least five different reuse potentials before we got to the solar park idea. So I think the city was really instrumental here, and we had a really great working relationship with the city and the state. So, you know, great working relationship as a team with all these stakeholders is the key.
Great, thanks. I've got another question for all three of you. We'll go one at a time, but cap maintenance. So who's responsible for things like mowing? So Scott, I want to start with you. I guess you may not have a mowing issue.
Well, there is. On the Hercules is still the responsible party, and they're responsible for the maintenance and monitoring the groundwater and everything. The dealership actually does keep an eye on things and on their part of the cap landfill, and they provide some security through additional fencing, and you know, just having a constant presence there. But Hercules maintains the facility overall.
Okay. Casey, you want to add to that?
Sure. The responsible party, Phillips 66, in conjunction with Sasol, are responsible for the operation and maintenance of the CAP and the surrounding area, in addition to the groundwater monitoring.
Okay. And Nabil?
Any settlement or repair issue, obviously it's the EPA responsibility. However, routine maintenance such as mowing and fencing and security, the city of Kokomo took over those responsibilities.
Okay, great. And we have time for a couple more questions. Can you guys talk about if you used a comfort letter, and does it remove people from liability? So let's see, Scott, did you have a comfort letter on yours?
I don't know, particularly in this instance, if a comfort letter was done, but it's likely that it has happened. You know, the comfort letter, bona fide prospective purchaser or prospective purchaser inquiry process, you know, does provide federal liability protections to potential purchasers or reusers of the site. But I don't know for sure if one was done at this site.
Okay, and I'm going to combine two questions here. Is your site still on the NPL, or was it
Hercules? Yes, it's still on the NPL.
Okay, I asked that someone raised the question, but I'm glad they did because it shows that reuse is possible. You don't have to delist a site to go ahead and reuse it. So I'm going to follow up with the same question. Casey, did you use a comfort letter, and is your site still on the NPL?
There was no comfort letter issued. Phillips 66 and Sasol were the responsible parties, and the containment cells are on Phillips 66 property. We do lots of comfort letters in Region 6, but we didn't do one for this project. And then what was the other question, Melissa?
Just a little bit of follow-up to that. So if you were to do a comfort letter, would someone no longer be a responsible party?
No. There's a national, EPA's developed a national template for our site status letters, also called comfort letters. We follow those very closely, as do all the rest of the regions. Comfort letters basically they summarize the current status of the site, they summarize the work that EPA has done at the site, they address appropriate reuse, and then they go through the liability protections developed in the Brownfield Amendments of 2002. Those liability protections are self-implementing. So EPA does not grant a liability exemption to anybody, and the comfort letter goes through that explanation.
Okay, and is your site still on the NPL?
This is a long-term removal action, and so it was not listed on the NPL.
Okay, great. Nabil, you talked a little bit about your experience with comfort letters.
Yeah, we wrote a comfort letter to the city of Kokomo back in 2013 when we transferred over the properties to them after we implemented institutional controls. And when this project went through, the developer and their banks wanted that comfort letter. They were aware of it, but they wanted a comfort letter of their own. So we went ahead and sent them another comfort letter that was very similar to what we provided the city already, which pretty much highlighted the institutional controls that are required at that piece of property, and also, you know, summarized what expected from the developer or what expected from them in order, you know, for us to maintain the protectiveness of our remedy.
Okay. And is your site still on the NPL?
Our site is on the NPL. It's going through a five-year review process, and one of our recommendations will be to explore delisting for the site.
Okay, great, thanks. Let's see, we have some more questions here. So one of you talked about cleanup running ahead of schedule. I can't remember which one of you it was, but whoever did that, tell us how that happened.
Well, that was Continental Steel, and basically in 2009, the region had some Recovery Act money available, and they were looking for shovel-ready projects, And luckily, I nominated Continental Steel, and we received $6 million, which kind of expedited the cleanup by little over 2 years, really.
Okay, great. I'm going to switch back now to something I really want to leave you with, which is a list of Superfund Redevelopment Initiative coordinators by region. And I also want to make sure you have the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative website so that you can take a look at everything that's on there. You can find out a lot more information. And as Gene said, you'll be able to get a recording of this program. Anything else?
We'll walk through just a couple of real quick reminders before I do that, though. Contact information for our lovely session moderator, Melissa Friedland, and her partner, Frank Avasado, who work here on the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, is up on the screen.
And I certainly want to thank our presenters. They've just done a terrific job explaining what happened and all the kind of things that maybe worked really well and lessons learned and working with local municipalities. And I hope that by listening to this discussion, it's expanded your knowledge on both the challenges and the possibilities at CAPT Superfund sites. So thank you very much to our presenters. So I think, Jean, you want to finish up?
Sure. So I will take just a moment and walk through a few final reminders regarding the webinar. As Melissa said, this session is part of an ongoing redevelopment initiative or SRI webinar series here. So you can browse the over 34 webinars that we have currently archived on the following page, and you'll continue to get alerts from us as we schedule and offer future ones, so make sure you sign up to have your name added to that distribution list if you'd like to attend these in the future. You can also download a copy of the presentation materials from the URLs that show up on the middle right of your screen. So under the related URLs, I'll draw your attention to a few links, one of them being the seminar resources page. You'll also have it linked to the seminar feedback form, and I will ask if you could take just a moment and fill out that online form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in its content and the mechanism that we used. If you are looking for a participation certificate, once you fill out the online feedback form, you can click a box at the bottom of that form to certify you were there for the whole session, and you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can download or print out for today's webinar. If you happen to share the line in a group, so a number of you were in a conference room together, each person can fill out their own feedback form and get their own copy of a participation certificate. And please know that I do read every single one of the submissions. So if you'd like to continue to see webinars offered like this or help us to improve future deliveries, I encourage you to share your thoughts online. And so with that, you will receive an email as soon as today's archive is available for free on-demand playback or download.